This year marks the 50th anniversary of the founding of the Adirondack Park Agency, the state agency tasked with regulating public and private land use in the vast geography stretching across the North Country of New York. And the creation of the agency is the subject of the new book, A Wild Idea, How the Environmental Movement Tamed the Adirondacks, by Brad Edmondson, an independent journalist who did 50 oral history interviews over 18 years to amass the history for this story. Brad Edmondson joins us now to discuss the development of the book, the creation of the Adirondack Park Agency, and how it compares to 50 years ago. So what was it that prompted you to get interested in this topic and eventually write a book about it?
A friend of mine who was directly involved in the events of the early 70s that created the APA took me aside one day and said, you know, the people who set the agency up have fantastic stories to tell, and they're all getting older, and none of them are writing things down themselves. How would you like to go do oral history interviews with these people? And I said, oh, that sounded interesting. So I got a grant from this guy who was the program officer for a foundation. For 5 years, 2002 to 2007, I went out and talked to two or three dozen people who were on the staff of the APA, people who were on the Temporary Study Commission, and board members. And also, as time went on, I got more and more interested in the opposition that arose to the Adirondack Park Agency. So I also interviewed people who organized against the Adirondack Park Agency. And, you know, I just discovered that this was a very, very rich story that evoked a lot of really basic themes about American society. So I just kept going. But I was, you know, I am an independent journalist. So when the grant money ran out, I had to make a living. So I put all the 1,500 pages of transcripts in a filing cabinet for 10 years. And then in 2017, I got back to the project, and it turns out that the 50th anniversary of the APA is this year. So the book is coming out in partnership with the Adirondack Experience Museum in Blue Mountain Lake to commemorate the 50th anniversary, but also to tell the story. And it is a heck of a story.
In politics at the Capitol, things typically happen because of either a precipitating event that might spur action, or it's the product of a lot of long and tireless work by advocates to, move the ball down the field and eventually get into the end zone. How does the Adirondack Park Agency fit into those narratives? Is this something that happened overnight as a result of precipitating event, or was it the product of a lot of long work?
More the latter than the former, although there were certain events that were very important in pushing the state toward making this very, very bold move to, to impose zoning regulations on 6 million acres of land and to have them enforced not by localities but by a state agency was really kind of unprecedented and very radical for its time. One of the precipitating events that really got people's attention was the construction of the interstate called the Northway that runs from Albany to Montreal. That made it a lot easier to get to the Adirondacks from big cities. And concurrent with that, there were a lot of proposals for large second home developments on the private land in the park. And at that time, in 1967, 68, there were virtually no zoning regulations on the private land in the park. So people like Paul Schaefer, Omi Coggeshall, David Newhouse, and other activists, as well as the wealthy camp owners who organized through the Association for the Protection of the Adirondacks, had been pushing for protection of the forest preserve for decades. But the opening of the Northway and a few other events, plus the very rapid rise of the environmental movement in the 1960s, gave them the opening they needed. And by the time the law was actually introduced to the legislature in 1971, it's one of the things I really try to do in this book is to put the reader back in that time when being in favor of environmental protection was something that every politician practically in the entire United States had to do because voter demands for environmental action were so overwhelming. And that was particularly true in New York State.
Well, speaking about the political fault lines that emerged over the creation of the Adirondack Park Agency, Can you discuss a little bit about who found themselves on what side of this issue in Albany? I mean, was it a partisan split? Was it a regional divide? Where did people fall and why?
No, it wasn't a partisan split. In fact, one of the really interesting things that I uncovered in this book was how party politics really didn't explain what happened at all. A lot of the people who were really pushing this idea were members of the Republican Party. And in fact, 50 years ago, the Republican Party was responsible for a lot of the major environmental legislation, both nationally and at the state level. Well, I think what it really came down to is whether or not you were loyal to Nelson Rockefeller or not. Nelson Rockefeller, the governor of New York at the time, he was probably the most powerful governor in the history of New York State. And he was personally had such great wealth that he also had this very well-funded private think tank that allowed him to produce extremely well-thought-out and extremely well-documented proposals, basically by paying for them himself, that made it very difficult for legislators to oppose him. The combination of his political power and his money really meant that if you were not going to side with Rockefeller, Democrat or Republican, you were going to travel a harder road. And Rockefeller, to his credit, I think, signed on to this regional zoning authority idea and spent a lot of political capital in order to make it happen.
You're listening to the Capitol Press Room, and we're talking with the independent journalist Brad Edmondson about his new book detailing the creation of the Adirondack Park Agency, A Wild Idea, How the Environmental Movement Tamed the Adirondacks. So I'm glad you brought up Governor Nelson Rockefeller, because his brother had his own idea about how best to regulate the Adirondack Park. Can you talk about that?
Yeah, that's the kind of an interesting wrinkle in this whole thing. It's one of the chapters, it's called Brotherly Love, because Nelson Rockefeller's younger brother, Lawrence Rockefeller, you know, these are two of the wealthiest men in the world at the time. And Lawrence Rockefeller's passion was creating great parks. He had a direct hand in the creation of at least three national parks. And he wanted the Adirondacks to turn into the next great national park as this superhighway was opening, which eased access to this vast, undeveloped territory. He wanted to claim it for the national park system and develop it with beaches and causeways and recreation centers and all of the things that you'd find in a national park, which is, frankly, much more oriented toward automobile recreation or automobile-oriented recreation than the Adirondack Forest Preserve is. So in 1967, Lawrence Rockefeller proposed that the Adirondacks become a national park. And everybody in New York just hated the idea. It just was dead on arrival. It was one of the few times that people in New York all agreed on something. They all hated this idea. But Nelson Rockefeller really loved his brother. And so to sidestep the controversy and to placate his brother, he formed a commission, the Temporary Study Commission on the Future of the Adirondacks. And told it to study the problem and come up with recommendations. Now, commissions usually, you know, don't amount to much. It's a kind of a common way for a politician to sweep a problem under the rug. But in this case, the Temporary Study Commission really caused very fundamental and lasting change. And a lot of the things that it came up with as recommendations are now taken for granted in the conservation movement internationally.
Can you elaborate a little bit on some of the recommendations from the commission that are kind of still with us today?
Yeah, well, they issued 181 recommendations. Recommendation number one was to establish the Adirondack Park Agency and give it control over development of the 6-million-acre park. But they also did all kinds of different things. They were really very early proponents, for example, of the idea of reintroducing species to areas where they'd been exterminated, the sort of reintroduction of things like otters and ravens and bobcats and all kinds of things, something that the Department of Environmental Conservation routinely does today, really traces back to the Temporary Study Commission's recommendations in 1970. One of the ones that I found the most interesting was they recommended that the state use conservation easements to protect land. Now, an easement is a pretty well recognized tool today, 50 years after they made this recommendation, where a private landowner will sell the development rights to a piece of scenic property, and so that landowner won't be able to develop the property, but they will continue to own it. And according to the terms of an easement, you can still cut trees, you can still keep trespassers away if you want, you can still, you know, do all kinds of things. You just sell the development rights. And it's cheaper to pick up an easement on a big piece of scenic land than it is to buy it outright. The Temporary Study Commission recommended that the state go whole hog into this technique, and it took New York about 13 or 14 years to pass a law that made it possible for that to happen. But today, conservation easements protect scenic areas in the United States that are roughly equivalent to the state of Pennsylvania in size. They've become a major conservation tool. And the Temporary Study Commission was really one of the first places where that idea was put on the table.
One of the big players in your story as it pertains to the Temporary Commission is Harold Gerry, who was responsible for leading the staff there. Can you explain his role at the time?
Yes. Harold Gerry was basically the executive director, the staff director of the Temporary Study Commission. So he was the liaison between the commissioners, who were, you know, wise men, and they were all men, who would make decisions and endorse the staff work, and this very young, very energetic staff who were tasked really to find out everything they could about the Adirondacks. They were given a very, very broad mandate. And Gerry, who was, I think, 48 years old when the Temporary Study Commission was formed, so he wasn't really all that young. Gerry had been a lieutenant colonel in the Army during World War II. He was intensely disciplined and very, very bright. He was a former state senator. Two crucial things about him, though, is that he was a friend of Nelson Rockefeller's, so the governor really trusted him. And also, he owned a wilderness camp in the southern Adirondacks that he was passionately devoted to. And he was on the record several times as saying that he thought that in the Adirondack backcountry, in these large privately owned forest tracts, there shouldn't be any development at all, ever. And he really drove the staff to amass a tremendous amount of knowledge about this huge park, both the natural history of it and the financial aspects of land ownership, the road system, and all, you know, anything you can name. They came out with 7 technical reports that altogether are about 900 pages of really dense findings. It's an amazing amount of work. And then simultaneously, Gerry worked with the commission to get the result he wanted, which was this very, very strong recommendation for protection of the open spaces of the Adirondacks from development.
And after a quick break, we'll continue our conversation with independent journalist Brad Edmondson about his new book detailing the creation of the Adirondack Park Agency, A Wild Idea, How the Environmental Movement Tamed the Adirondacks.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by the New York State AFL-CIO, a federation of 3,000 unions fighting for working people by keeping New York State union strong. UnionStrongNY.com for more information.
We're continuing our discussion with independent journalist Brad Edmondson about his new book detailing the creation of the Adirondack Park Agency, A Wild Idea, How the Environmental Movement Tamed the Adirondacks. Your book includes an anecdote about a fateful meeting between Harold Hochschild, yeah, and the Assembly Speaker in 1971. Can you explain their roles in this story and what happened in that encounter that contributed to the creation of the APA shortly after?
The Study Commission issued all these recommendations, and in 1971, only one of them made it to the floor of the Senate, and it was the recommendation to create the Adirondack Park Agency. And the senators and assemblymen from the North Country, those who represented the park, knew immediately that this was going to be bad for business. There was a bunch of new red tape, and it was unwelcome. And so they really did everything they could to organize against it. But they were really swimming against the tide because, as I said, in 1971, to be in favor of environmental protection was kind of a necessity for politicians, particularly those that represented big cities. And in New York State, the vast majority of senators and assemblymen represented big cities. So the North Country legislators, led by a guy named Glenn Harris, did a really good job of stalling things and slowing the process down and getting to the last day of the session. But Rockefeller really said, this is going to get done. We're going to get this thing done. There was one issue that needed to be resolved before the thing could go to the floor for a vote. And the Speaker of the Assembly, Perry Duryea, who was a Republican, they controlled the Assembly at that time, and who also wanted to be governor. He wanted Nelson Rockefeller's job. He had to preserve his environmental bona fides. But he was also representing the concerns of these North Country legislators. You know, the law was going to pass, but he tried to say, let the law not take effect until the end of the building season this year, so that people who have plans can get their stakes in the ground and get started at least this one more season. And the other key figure in this story is Harold Hochschild, who's an industrialist who is long retired. He was 78 years old at the time of this meeting. And he was very much committed to the idea of protecting the Adirondacks from development. He was really on board with what Harold Jerry was doing. And so at midnight, before the last day of the session, when Duryea was finally finished with all the other business, they arranged for a meeting where Duryea and Hochschild were going to discuss this one sticking point of whether or not the law should take effect immediately or if it should be delayed until September. And Duryea makes this pitch to Hochschild, who was about 6 feet tall, has a big shock of white hair and a booming voice. Hochschild's about 5 feet two. He's extremely nearsighted. As I said, he's 79 years old. So he's just sitting quietly in his chair in front of the desk. Duryea stands up and makes a speech and says, please, won't you do this one thing? It would help so much. He finally finishes talking, and all Hochschild says is, no, I would rather have no bill than that bill. Now, Hochschild had a secret weapon, which is that he was really tight with the editorial page editor of the New York Times, a guy named Johnny Oakes. And Oakes would basically print what Hochschild sent him. And Hochschild was prepared, if Duryea didn't do what Hochschild said, Hochschild was going to call up Johnny Oakes and say who was responsible for the failure of this bill, and it would be hung around Perry Duryea's neck. And Duryea knew this. So Duryea knew he was beat when Hochschild said no. And he, you know, according to several eyewitnesses I spoke with, his shoulders slumped, and he looked around, and he said, okay, pass the f***ing thing.
You're listening to the Capitol Press Room, and we're talking with the independent journalist Brad Edmondson about his new book detailing the creation of the Adirondack Park Agency, A Wild Idea, How the Environmental Movement Tamed the Adirondacks. So as the APA, gets up and running 50 years ago, what kind of resources did it have, and what was its mandate as part of this new law?
So the APA, which was formed in June of 1971, was ordered to produce two land use plans, one for the state-owned land in the Adirondack Park, which is known as the Forest Preserve, which covers about 2.6 million acres, and the other for the privately owned land in the park, which covers about 3.5 million acres. So the state-owned land is about the size of Yellowstone National Park, if you put all the acreage together, and the private land is about the size of the state of Connecticut. So nobody had ever done a land use plan for that much territory before. And there was also a brand new way of doing the plan that was based on the ideas of a planner named Ian McHarg. The idea was that you would look at the characteristics of the land, the soil, the slope, the wildlife, the vegetation, and all kinds of different things, and rate it according to how much development it could bear before it would negatively affect the overall environment around that particular acre. McHarg's ideas were intended for cities, but the APA decided to use those ideas on this 6 million acre piece of property that was a mixture of state and private land. So the APA had to produce two land use plans using that method, and they had to have both of them finished inside of 2 years. 1971 was a very bad year for the New York State budget. So the first year the APA's appropriation was $250,000, which was, you know, not all that much even in 1971. And then because of a budget crisis, it was cut to $150,000. So they really didn't have enough money to hire an adequate staff, and they really didn't have enough time to really do the best possible job. But they also had a youthful and very talented staff that was determined to do this plan successfully. And so the latter part of the book where I talk about writing the plan is a lot more dramatic than you might think, because they're really racing against the clock and doing something that had never been done before.
So considering the burden that was placed on the Adirondack Park Agency, how did George Davis, the 29-year-old leader of the staff for the agency, and his team go about getting this all done?
Yeah, so Davis is really a pivotal figure in this story, and he's still around, too. He lives in Portland, Oregon. But he was fresh out of Cornell Department of Natural Resources. He was a graduate student there. He had been a forest ranger. And, you know, he didn't have money and he didn't have time, but he had the thing that 29-year-olds do have, which is confidence that, you know, this impossible task was going to be no problem. And he was really passionate about the cause of protecting the park from development. So he was really very smart, very creative, and very passionate. And he turned out to be a very inspiring leader for this group of about a dozen people, many of whom were his age or younger, their first jobs out of school, who, you know, basically they all got in their cars and spent a year driving around, looking out the windshield and measuring different qualities of Adirondack land, and then coming back and writing it all up on these maps that became the core of the land plan. And they managed to produce a plan for public comment that worked according to their specifications, but was just not at all acceptable from the standpoint of the people who actually lived in the Adirondack Park.
So how did that get resolved then?
Well, you know, the way a lot of things in New York politics get resolved, by a lot of yelling and screaming and threatening, and then an eventual compromise that leaves everyone unsatisfied. So the land use plan came out at the end of 1972 for public comment, and they essentially collected public comment for the next 3 weeks. And there were these hearings throughout the Adirondack Park that were just sort of like WWE wrestling SmackDown matches, where people were yelling and screaming, and the chair of the Adirondack Park Agency, Richard Lawrence, another key figure in this story, really, really struggling to keep the roof from blowing off the hall, as he said. But a lot of people noticed errors in the plan, land that had been misclassified, things that were wrong. And so after the plan came out, the poor APA staff, who had just knocked themselves senseless to produce the draft plan, had to go get right back into their cars and spend another 3 months checking out all of these revision requests. And they eventually made over 500 revisions in just a space of a few weeks to produce a revised plan that was submitted to the legislature in March. And then once it was submitted to the legislature, as a statewide political issue, the intense support for environmental protection really took over.
When you think about the Adirondack Park Agency today and that organization 50 years ago, how does it compare to what the founders had envisioned?
That's a great question. And I think the key to understanding that question is to understanding the answer to that question is that the Adirondack Park Agency is 100% a creation of the governor. The governor appoints the board members. And the governor really controls, therefore, the overall tenor and orientation of the park agency. It's not a legislative organization. It's part of the executive chamber. So the Adirondack Park Agency reflects the priorities of the various people who've been governor of New York State. And in 1971, the governor was a guy who really enjoyed big, bold ideas. He didn't particularly worry about taking risks, as long as, in his judgment, it was politically a winning bet. And the environmental movement was in its youth, and a lot of environmentalists really treated their cause as, you know, it's kind of a holy war. People didn't really think. One very prominent activist told me that when they were pushing for the APA law to be passed, they didn't think at all about the people who lived in the park and how this would affect them. They were so focused on saving land that they forgot that 100,000 people lived there. And I think over the last 50 years, the conservation movement in general, and the APA in particular, has realized that you can't really do a good job of protecting land unless you accommodate and ensure decent lives for the people who live on the land. You know, it's a constant balance. I don't know anybody who's thrilled with their local zoning board, and the APA is essentially a zoning board for 6 million acres. So it's constantly in a position of saying no to people and producing compromises that satisfy no one. But I think that this accommodation of land protection with balancing the needs of the society in which that goes on and around the wild areas is really a lasting accomplishment that New York can be very proud of.
Well, unfortunately, we're going to have to leave it there for today. Our guest has been Brad Edmondson. He's an independent journalist and author of the new book, A Wild Idea: How the Environmental Movement Tamed the Adirondacks. Brad, thank you so much for making the time, and congrats on the book.
David, thanks for inviting me.
And if you enjoyed this discussion, check out awildidea.com, where you can get a discounted copy of Brad Edmondson's new book and sign up for updates on the 50th anniversary news about the Adirondack Park Agency, including a free virtual symposium that's coming up and a documentary this fall.
Support for the Capitol Press Room is provided by New York State United Teachers, a union of professionals in education, human services, and healthcare.
Join us again for Capitol Press Room, a production of WCNY Connected, Syracuse.